Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals for this panel, October 10, 2019. We have six cases on our schedule today, two for in-person oral argument, two for interactive television argument, and two for non-oral. So we have the full spectrum. Our first case on for oral argument is Stern 1011 and others versus Kenneth Gear and others. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep track of the lawyers in our oral collection of materials. The podium does raise and lower at your convenience. There's a button in front if the height doesn't match your convenience. Feel free to raise it or lower it. Counsel, whenever you're ready, appellant's counsel, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Scott Knutson, representing the appellants Kenneth Gear and Planned Investments in Gear 1011. With me at council table is Marn Forty, also with the firm of Briggs & Morgan. We're here because Mr. Gear is seeking to get what he bargained for in 2007, over 12 years ago. What the respondents also agreed to, which is to provide for reform through arbitration to resolve any disputes between the parties. Arbitration is a form of dispute resolution that is strongly favored in Minnesota law. The key issue in this case is the statute of limitations. Minnesota law also favors the application of statute of limitations. It's an important purpose to the statute of limitations, but the passage of time, such as we have in this case, memories fade. People have a difficult time remembering what happened. Documents may have gone astray. So what we're seeking for, first of all, is to have an order reversing the district court and remanding this case to arbitration. To start, I'd like to address the standard of review. I think we've said it's de novo review. Respondents have not taken issue with that. That issue of de novo review applies both to the interpretation of the contract but also on the issue of waiver, because on this record, there are undisputed facts as to what happened below, and whether or not what happened below constitutes a waiver is something this court can address de novo.
Intent, however, is a factual matter, isn't it?
But they inferred intent through what happened in the course of the proceedings below. So we have authority that when the facts are undisputed, the court can go and address the question of waiver on de novo review. So even though there is an issue of intent, the subjective intent is not the issue. It's clear on record here that Mr. Gear always reserved his right to compel arbitration. So if you look for expressions of intent, the record's undisputed that he attempted to bring his motion to dismiss without prejudice to his right to arbitration. That was expressly stated in the motion papers, footnote 4, in the memorandum of law, also in correspondence with the court, saying, we intend to invoke our right to arbitration as agreed to by the parties in their contract. So on this record, the question of intent can be decided from what the parties did. And in fact, if you look at what the district court held, he said there is no dispute as to what's happened, and from there I can determine waiver. So his decision, the district court's decision on waiver, rested on the fact that Mr. Gear moved to dismiss for a statute of limitations ground as a threshold matter.
Now, there would be nothing prohibiting Mr. Gear from having brought both a motion to compel arbitration and a motion to dismiss.
This is true, and that's the Rogers v. Silver situation, where this court held that in that circumstance, the district court should first decide the issue of arbitration, and in that case, send the matter to arbitration.
So why doesn't that, the fact that that case existed and the choice not to move for compelled arbitration in conjunction with the motion to dismiss leave the district court's decision intact as to intent?
Well, Rogers v. Silver was decided after this case got started. So the roadmap that the district court relied on was not something that was available to Mr. Gear at the start of the litigation. Mr. Gear moved.
Legal question was still.
It was an open question as to what would happen in that circumstance, because no appellate court had ruled in those circumstances whether or not the question of concurrent motions to compel arbitration or to dismiss, how should the district court proceed in that circumstance?
But there have been other cases where the question of a litigant's intent, where an individual might waive the arbitration right by conduct in the litigation, by participating in the litigation.
I understand that, Your Honor. And so in the circumstances, in the sequencing of events, January 2018, this is when Mr. Gear moves to dismiss. The Rogers v. Silver case is decided months later. So
November.
Yes. So that has not, there's no guidance coming from the appellate courts as to what to do in that particular circumstance. If you look at the case law with respect to waiver by conduct, litigation conduct, on the question of arbitration, we think this case is within the confines of Illinois Farmers, the case where the Supreme Court distinguished two other cases to hold that arbitration, the right to arbitration or to compel arbitration, had not been waived, because in Illinois Farmers, the case was in the very early stages, that the party seeking arbitration had not advanced the merits of the dispute in court. Whereas in Anderson and Brothers Yurowitz, you had a circumstance in which the party that ultimately sought arbitration had engaged in discovery, had taken depositions, and I believe in Anderson, their motion for a summary judgment. Now, moving to dismiss on statute of limitations may be technically a merits defense because of res judicata. In other words, the ruling on that could be binding in a subsequent proceeding. But if you look at what the court said, and the best way for me to describe this case name is Granite Ray. It's an insurance case. And there the Minnesota Supreme Court describes a limitations defense as really a threshold defense. It doesn't negate liability. So it doesn't get to the merits of this, the dispute between the parties, only whether or not the timing when the case was brought falls within the limitations period or not. So we think if you look at Illinois Farmers, its analysis of the issue of waiver by litigation conduct, we fall within that holding because, first of all, we made it clear from the get-go that we were going to invoke our right to arbitration. It was the first affirmative defense when Mr. Gear finally had to answer.
Now, was the limitations defense was not the only basis for the motion to dismiss, was it, in this case?
This was. We moved on 9B grounds that they hadn't adequately pled fraudulent concealment, which is...
That's a merits-based argument, isn't it?
Well, it's a pleading argument. In other words, you, in your complaint, have not had sufficient allegations to establish the threshold requirements of a fraudulent claim for fraud, which is what fraudulent concealment is. Who said what, when, and where? It's just a naked pleading that Mr. Gear fraudulently concealed what happened at the post-closing. So that issue really isn't a merits issue either, because it's a pleading deficiency. And the remedy there, if the court had agreed with us, would be to dismiss the case with leave to amend and try to satisfy with sufficient good faith basis allegations that would establish fraudulent concealment. So the primary purpose of the motion to dismiss was to get a statute of limitations invoked, and one thing we had to argue was the allegation of fraudulent concealment was ineffective. It didn't meet the pleading requirements of 9B.
Didn't you actually make the motion both on statute of limitations grounds and on grounds of the provision in the party's agreement for a one-year limitation period?
Well, the limitations period was both the statutory six-year period and the one-year contractual limitations period. but they're both a statute of limitations defense. One is by operations.
One's a statute of limitations, and one's a contractual limitation.
The analysis, though, in terms of the effect on the case is the same.
But the contractual limitation motion is a little bit different in that you asked the district court to dig in and start looking at the provisions of the agreement. That was part of your motion.
Well, then if you look at the Davies decision, in that case, the Court of Appeals said, there's nothing here to interpret. The provision on arbitration is unambiguous. And therefore, you don't really get into a sort of a contested case where one party, who said what and when. You know, you can read the language of the agreement. That's the objective expression of the party's intent. The court can interpret that provision as a matter of law. Therefore, I would argue that both the statutory limitations period and the agreed upon contractual limitations period are analyzed the same way.
Has our court, you're familiar with the Nitz case?
The name's familiar, but I'm drawing a blank.
It was a 1990 case that arguably stands for the proposition that is a dismissal based on the statute of limitations is on the merits.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. That goes back to the point I made earlier, though, is that although technically a merits defense for purposes of what res judicata would apply, if you look at the Granite Ray case, the analysis of a limitations defense is that it goes to defeat the right to bring a merits claim, not whether or not the claim itself is meritorious. And therefore, if you're looking at waiver by virtue of litigation conduct, then I think you have to look at Illinois Farmers. Because Nitz would not bar the motion for arbitration simply because the first effort was to use the efficacy of the motion to dismiss to raise a statute of limitations defense. Rather, Nitz simply says that's a merits defense, but Granite Ray says it's really not going to the true merits of the case. And if you're looking at litigation conduct as the means to imply waiver, then you need to look at Illinois Farmers and take a look at where this case and how it compares to Illinois Farmers in terms of the progress of litigation with respect to the merits. Here, we have no discovery, really, to speak of. We had to answer some discovery because by operation of the rules, requests for admission are deemed admitted if you don't respond in 30 days. And interrogatories, you waive certain objections if you don't make a timely response. But there's been no real discovery in terms of exchange of documents, depositions, naming of experts, none of that. So we're really at the nascent stage of this case in terms of it.
So, Mr. Knudsen, just given that time is short, let me just ask you, if we reach the issue, and I understand what you have arguments about why we shouldn't, but about whether the arbitration clause was unreasonable as a matter of law, just give us your best argument about why the Peggy Rose case shouldn't say, tell us, we need to rule against you. Because that case, when I read it, is both on the tolling issue, and I think there it was 18 months as opposed to the year, kind of pretty on point.
Well, I think there's a critical distinction between Peggy Rose and this case. And the distinction I would draw is, let's look at the Davies case and the contractual limitations period in the Davies case. And if you look at the Davies case and that limitations period and look at the one that's in our case, the limitation period starts to run when the events that gave rise to the claim took place. It's very similar to the Davies limitations period. And why that's different than Peggy Lee is, Peggy Lee says that the period runs from a fixed date, regardless of discovery. In that case, it was the closing on a transaction. We would be within Peggy Lee if the limitations period said within 1 year of closing on the real estate loan. But it doesn't say that. There are other events that took place after the closing that could arguably give rise to a claim against Mr. Gear. So they're not bound by a fixed period, such as was in Peggy Lee, but rather something, a provision analogous to the Davies case, which this court upheld. been applied. So that's my response there, is I think Peggy Lee does not control. Rather, you could look to Davies, look at provisions in our case. They're very, very similar to those in Davies that was upheld. Ergo, I would say Peggy Lee doesn't control. It's limited to its specific facts. And indeed, if I could get to the question of the tolling provision, in terms of who gets to decide that, I think that is for the arbitrator to decide. And whether or not the one-year period is unreasonable, take a look at Granite Ray. There, the court said that because the parties didn't specifically contract around the tolling, equitable tolling doctrine, it would apply to the limitations period, and the arbitrator could decide whether equitable tolling applied. If the parties wanted to eliminate that defense to the statute of limitations, they had to specifically contract to do so. But the court, by saying that, says it would be reasonable for the parties to agree to a very strict limitations period where the doctrine of equitable tolling did not apply. So I think if you read Granite Ray, with Davies, the party's freedom to contract should control here. And therefore, the one-year limitations period should be reasonable based on what happened in Davies and what the court said in Granite Ray and what the legislature has said in 572B.06 sub C.
Thank you. Your time has expired, but you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Renz. I'm representing the respondents Stern 1011 First Street South and Haberman 1011 First Street South. Your Honor, the respondents are asking that this court affirm the district court's denial of the appellant's motion to compel arbitration on three bases. One, that the district court was correct that the appellants waived their ability to compel arbitration. Two, that the district court was the appropriate body to determine whether the arbitration clauses contained unreasonable time periods. And three, that those time limitations were, as the district court determined, unreasonably short. For all these reasons, the Court of Appeals should affirm the district court. I'd like to start with the waiver argument, which obviously the court spent the most time on with the appellant's counsel. Your Honor, the appellants waived their right to compel arbitration in this matter. The appellants, when faced with the claims by the respondents, represented by very able counsel, made a decision as to how to respond. And instead of immediately bringing a motion to compel arbitration, which would also have stayed the proceedings, they filed a comprehensive motion to dismiss, including contentions about the sufficiency of fraud pleadings under the rules of civil procedure and arguments about the statute of limitations in addition to the arbitration arguments they made. In fact, telling the district court that its job was to, quote, determine whether the complaint sets forth a legally sufficient claim for relief, unquote. They filed almost 350 pages of affidavits and exhibits to back that up, contrary to their claim that it wasn't an exhaustive and extensive motion.
Counsel, I understand what you're saying on that front, but
yes,
on my concern on your waiver argument is that it does look to me like the evidence of prejudice to your client's pretty weak. I mean, there was a lot of discovery, but discovery can be used elsewhere, right? Could you address, just directly address the prejudice issue for me?
I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. A couple points on that. One, I would look to what is the prejudice that is required in order to, in this setting, for waiving the right to compel arbitration. And I think that the case that was square on with that is the Hooper case, admittedly a persuasive case out of the Eighth Circuit. But they talk about the fact that the prejudice threshold is not onerous, and in fact they cite a number of other circuits, and that if you litigate substantial issues on the merits and there's a duplication of efforts as between what you've done in district court and what you'll do in arbitration, that holding, and I think that's correct, is that that is enough, that is sufficient prejudice to support waiver. The bottom line is that the appellants in this case could very well have done either what the Rogers versus Silver litigants did, or simply just bring a motion to compel arbitration and put the whole thing to bed, but they didn't.
So is your argument really that when, I mean, this seems like maybe you're asking us to publish an opinion that says that when a litigant makes a motion to dismiss to the district court in this circumstance, there is a waiver.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked that, because that's not our argument. We are not saying that there's a per se argument. What we're saying is that when you, we see the cases as setting out kind of two camps in this area. One camp is that you file a motion, motion to dismiss with the district court, arguing only the jurisdictional question, the where and how. I think that's how the Illinois Farmers case talks about it. So all it says there is, all I want you to tell us is that we should be in arbitration. But if you don't do that, and instead you use the district court, you invoke it and engage it to substantively review the plaintiff's claims, and then you go on to do, in fact, other pieces of the litigation, you have decided, you've elected to go the district court route. And that's exactly what happened here. It's what
the notwithstanding the indication in the pleadings that that isn't what they intended to do?
Well, I appreciate that's what they're written. I think actions speak louder than words, Your Honor. I'd again point to Hooper, where they say a reservation of rights is not an assertion of rights. And that's exactly what our position is. I appreciate that they've put fine print on the bottom of each of their pleadings. Hey, just in case, we might bring a motion to compel arbitration in the future. It doesn't change what they did in this case. They chose to invoke the district court for much more than the mere jurisdictional question. This is the proverbial second bite of the apple about which the Hooper court warned. In that case, there was only 4.5 months of passage and a 15-page opposition brief. This is far more. They participated in a joint discovery plan where they agreed to mediate the case, even further taking it out of arbitration, a joint discovery plan which was filed.
Can you address the issue of, I recognize that you're framing this as a decision on the merits. Mr. Knudsen argues that these are really pleading deficiencies we're talking about, not on the merits, that you don't really get into the substance despite language in other cases that frame limitations issues as issues of merit. And the question of the fraud pleading is just a matter of a pleading deficiency, not a substantive deficiency in the pleadings, or not a substantive deficiency on the merits.
Understood. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, well, I would point, first of all, to those decisions. I would hold out NITS chiefly as a statute of limitations is, in fact, a decision on the merits. And again, for the sake of simplicity, I would point to how much they submitted in an effort to get this case dismissed. I mean, remember that they have 350 pages of affidavits and exhibits. That is far more than a jurisdictional question. They challenged the statutes of limitation, as well as the sufficiency of the fraud pleading, and they require the court to go into a substantive analysis. It's wholly different from merely asking the court to put this into arbitration, which is kind of the beat that they are beating now, is that all we want is the arbitration. But what they really tried to do was see if they could get the district court to let them out of some or all of the claims without having to go to arbitration. And then when they didn't like that result, they went ahead and tried another bite at the apple by bringing a motion to compel arbitration. But by that point, they had invoked the litigation machinery of the district court and thereby waived their ability to seek arbitration.
Were there cases other than NITS that you think NITS is the most persuasive case on the question of whether a limitations argument is always a matter outside of the merits?
That is the case that most readily comes to mind, Your Honor. It's also the case that the district court cited for the same proposition.
I understand.
I think it's right.
When you say it's the case that most readily comes to mind, are you aware of any other case that stands for the proposition?
It's the only case that comes to mind on that. Your Honor, moving on from that, the district court is the appropriate body to determine the reasonableness of this limitations period. The Minnesota Court of Appeals in Davie, is incredibly clear that courts decide matters of arbitrability. And whether an arbitration clause is unreasonable in duration so as to preclude enforcement is a question of arbitrability. Appellants suggest, particularly in their most recent submissions to this court, that Minnesota Statute 572B.06C instead controls and somehow contravenes Davies. And they try and explain Davies away by saying, well, the cause of action in Davies arose before August 1, 2011. That's the date that statute was put into place, and therefore it just didn't come into play. There's a number of problems with this contention. First of all, this court would have, if that statute was on point, in the least mentioned it in its decision. It is mentioned nowhere. It's not footnoted. Second, this court decided to make that a published decision. If there was a statute in the interim that had basically rendered the decision moot, it wouldn't have published its decision. And third, the statute is procedural. In that case, that the Davies litigation wasn't initiated until August 11th of 2011. That statute was already in place. It was procedural. If it had applied, it would have been used. For all those reasons, the Davies case is not somehow supplanted by 572B.06C. And if you take a second and look at the statute, excuse me, if anything, 572B.06B is the part of the statute that would control, where a court decides whether a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. The language in C presupposes that there's a valid agreement to arbitrate. All it says the arbitrator does is decide whether a condition precedent has been fulfilled and whether a contract is enforceable that contains a valid agreement to arbitrate, not whether the agreement to arbitrate is valid. For all these reasons, Your Honor, the district court was the appropriate body to determine the reasonableness, and that court should affirm. Lastly, Your Honor, the arbitration clause in this case was, as the district court determined, unreasonably short. As the court, Judge Jessen pointed out, there is the Peggy Rose case that talks about this. It is an reasonably short limitation period and therefore unenforceable if it deprives a party of ability to vindicate its rights. And that happens where a party's claim is barred by that period before the loss or damage can be ascertained. Here we have an inflexible one-year timeline. Arbitration says arbitration shall be commenced within 1 year from the date of the event giving rise to the dispute. Be careful, because appellants keep saying it's the date the event giving rise to the claim. And what they do is try and roll that into, well, it contains a tolling period. The district court was onto this and spent time in its decision talking about the fact that's not really what the agreement says. It is an inflexible one-year provision with no allowance for late discovery due to fraud or concealment, which, as the court is aware, is exactly what the respondents are alleging occurred here, with closing statements with fraudulent signatures, alternate statements forged to hide that, significant self-enrichment, continued denial, and cover-up. Where this arbitration clause, as it's written, applied, it would condone the appellant's fraud, and it would deprive the respondents of the ability to vindicate their rights. The issue, of course, is that the time restriction in this arbitration agreement is tied to the event giving rise to the dispute. There's no allowance for late discovery. It's very much like Peggy Rose, where there was an 18-month from the date of closing. The appellant's first contention in response to this in their reply brief is that, well, this arbitration clause, if you really read it, is from discovery. It has some kind of built-in tolling provision. One, as I just stated, the language doesn't provide that. Two, it's contrary to appellant's previous positions. As we pointed out in our briefing, they were very clear with the district court that their position was it's 1 year from the date of that closing and the date disbursements were made. Third, I would point to Peggy Rose, where they say it is not proper to impose a tolling requirement for claims of fraud where the plain language of the agreement does not suggest that one was contemplated. Nothing in this language suggests one was contemplated, and therefore it's not appropriate to put one in. Instead, this arbitration agreement is unenforceable. Lastly, Your Honor, the appellants contend, well, this arbitration clause is just like the one in Davies, and in Davies they upheld the arbitration clause. The comparison with Davies is inappropriate. In Davies, there were no allegations of fraud. In fact, a complaint was filed within, I think, 30 days of the date that the action accrued. Davies had to do with whether or not it was subject to arbitration or they could bring a district court action. They never undertook the analysis that Peggy Rose did, and in fact, they talk about Peggy Rose as a distinctly different set of facts because Peggy Rose involved fraud, the very thing we have in this case. Davies is not applicable. Your Honors, for all these reasons, the district court was correct that this inflexible arbitration clause was unreasonably short and unenforceable. And for all these reasons, we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's decision.
What do you feel is your stronger position, if we had to choose one, the first issue that you raise or the next two combined?
I think our stronger position is the second, if I were to choose one. I think either is dispositive, but in answer to your question, the second.
On the first issue, waiver of the right to arbitration, is, from your perspective, is the law clear in this area, or is this an area that if we address this issue, whichever way the court decides, that we should be publishing on it? You want to add, give us your perspective on that?
I think that the case law is clear. I don't think that this is necessary after, and the case is escaping my mind, we've talked about a couple times, it happened in November after this case was filed.
You're speaking of the Rogers case.
Thank you. With Rogers versus Silva already out there, I don't think it's necessary to publish. I think the case law is clear and that the concepts in the law were already clear before the appellants filed their motion to dismiss. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. What we have here is basically...
Just a quick reminder, remember to begin with your name.
Scott Knutson for the appellants.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. What the respondents are advocating is that there is a per se rule, a one-year limitations period without a tolling provision is invalid. That is not the law. If you read Granite Ray clearly says, and this is the Minnesota Supreme Court, that you can contract around the tolling, equitable tolling defense. Therefore, to say that the provision is unreasonable in this case because there is no provision for equitable tolling misreads and misapplies Granite Ray. Two, they admit, the district court did note, they took over 2 years to file their complaint. So to say that 1 year is unreasonably short, well, what, 2 years is sufficient? They sat on their rights, and they should be held to waive those rights by virtue of failing to file within the one-year period of time. With respect to prejudice, the Feedy case says the passage of time alone is not prejudice. And respondents rely on this Eighth Circuit decision, the Hooper case. The Hooper case doesn't articulate a per se rule that a motion to dismiss automatically waives the right to arbitrate, and in fact, they concede that. What Hooper is saying is similar to what we've been arguing, which is how far into the case and what complexity is being advanced. And there, they said the district court was engaged into a deep dive into Missouri law. This is not the case here at all. So I don't think Hooper is controlling. Of course, it's a federal case, not a Minnesota case. And on that point, let's get to Davies. He says Davies didn't address 572B.06, yet the case was filed after the law became effective. But let me just inform the court. 572B.03 says that provision, this is the statute that applies today, applies to arbitration agreements entered into after August 1, 2011. And that's why 572B.06 was not addressed in Davies, because it didn't apply by virtue of the statute saying it doesn't apply to agreements entered into before August 1, 2011.
Can I turn your attention to some language in Davies regarding the substantive question of reasonableness? But Peggy Rose involved unusual circumstances because the respondent in that case asserted fraud claims, and the Supreme Court interpreted the limitations provision in the arbitration agreement to not include a discovery provision. Why doesn't this distinction in Davies clarify that this case fits under the Peggy Rose scenario more than the Davies scenario?
Well, I think what we can do here, because these get very granular in terms of the distinctions, but our agreement to arbitrate doesn't preclude an assertion of equitable tolling. And I think that's what Peggy Rose is saying, is if you have that availability.
So you would ask this court or the district court to include a provision into the contract that the parties didn't expressly or implicitly intend to include?
Well, Granite Ray says that, in fact, if you do not contract out equitable tolling, the doctrine applies.
So that's, did they then overrule Peggy Rose? Because I'm just looking at that part of the decision where they said it is not proper to impose a tolling requirement for claims of fraud where the plain language of the agreement does not suggest that one was contemplated. I mean, that's what it says. That's,
you're saying that's what they say in Granite Ray?
That's what Peggy Rose. In Peggy Rose.
Well, I think to reconcile the two is that Granite Ray being 2014, Peggy Rose 2002, 12 years earlier, that clearly expressing the party's right to contract out equitable tolling means that if they don't exclude that defense, the doctrine applies to the contract and also to the arbitration provision. So that's how you have to reconcile the two cases. And the later should be the more clear expression of Supreme Court's interpretation of what the law should be in this circumstance. With respect to the 345 pages, those was there to provide context but not to address the merits. We clearly did not argue on the basis of those submissions that they lose on the merits. We wanted to be able to tell a story so the judge knew the context in which all of this occurred, because there's lots of accusations of theft and lying, and we thought there's more to this story and the court ought to know that. We don't expect the court to have ruled on the merits of that case, but we just want to be able to tell that story. That's why we put it in there. I see my time's expired, unless the court has another question they'd like me to answer.
Looks like none from the bench. Thank you both for your written arguments and for your oral representation for your clients, all of whom should be happy with their representation. We appreciate your arguments. The matter is submitted, and under advisement, we'll issue our opinion within the 90-day statutory period.
Thank you.